Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, June 14th, 2018. I'd like to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. Let's start with announcements. Here's an update on the Earth First Round River Rendezvous 2018. It's going to be held July 1st through the 19th, in so-called Southeast Ohio. This year, the annual Round River Rendezvous will be hosted by Appalachia Resist from July 1st to 9th in SoCal, Southeast Ohio, on occupied Seneca, Shawnee, and Salagi land. The location will be near Athens, Ohio. Directions will be posted later. And the nearest airport is in Columbus, Ohio. Appalachia Resist is asking that anyone with kids or knows someone who's coming with kids send an email to appalachiaresist@gmail.com so they can get an idea of the amount and ages of kids who will be coming. That's appalachiaresist@gmail.com. We want to make this rendezvous great for families, so if you can't be there for the first 2 days and would be willing to sign up for childcare or kids' workshops, send us an email so the first few days of childcare and workshops can be scheduled ahead of time. As of June 11th, there is a rideshare board available for people driving to the rendezvous. More info from Appalachia Resist's website. While we're still working up the workshop schedule, some likely workshops are map reading, radio comms and convoys, de-escalation, solidarity with impacted communities, community self-defense, pipeline skills exchange, indigenous resistance and solidarity, mutual aid disaster relief, and standard rendezvous fare such as direct action, plant identification, know your rights, digital security, jail solidarity, scouting, pipeline construction and fracking infrastructure, security culture, and self-defense. Average temperatures in this region in July are 84 degrees in the day with lows of 61 at night. It will be very humid and feel like much higher. The record high for this week was 101 degrees with very high humidity. The record low was 47. Expect thunderstorms at some point during the week. That means bring rain gear and have rainproof bedding. There will be many insects available for your study, including mosquitoes and ticks. There is a high chance you will encounter poison ivy. Nights around here can be very noisy with the mating, kinship, and territorial calls of frogs, insects, birds, and mammals that are active at night. There are three venomous snakes in the area, rattlesnakes, copperheads, and possibly cottonmouths. You are unlikely to be lucky enough to see one of them. Coyote and bobcats are the largest predators that live in the area, although eastern black bear have been sighted passing through. You're also unlikely to be lucky enough to see any of these either, although we are likely to hear the coyotes. We're trying to make this year's rendezvous the most kid-friendly rendezvous ever, with workshop responsibilities and discussions with and for the kids. You can help by bringing your kids or encouraging and helping your friends who have kids to attend. Those without kids who want to help can also come prepared to sign up for childcare shifts or teach a workshop. If you have kids or experience working with kids, send us requests and ideas. Child care will be provided except during meal times. Check back for the child care curriculum. Breakfast and dinner will be provided. You should bring your own lunch and snacks or any meals if you don't want to eat in the communal area. And I don't have the webpage for Appalachia Resist, but you could try appalachiaresist.org. Try that. An indigenous land defender has been killed in Mexico in this story from Intercontinental Cry magazine, as found on the Earth First Newswire. On May 14th, Manuel Gaspar Rodriguez was taken from the offices of the MIOCUP and brutally stabbed to death by unknown assailants. He had been the subject of repeated death threats for his work against large-scale mining and hydroelectric projects in the Sierra Norte de Puebla in Mexico. Early this year, Manuel Gaspar was one of eight community leaders charged by Mexico's CFE, that's their electrical utility company, for participating in blockades of a major transmission line. The Sierra Norte de Puebla is predominantly Nahua and Totonaco indigenous region located immediately north of the city of Puebla, Mexico. Over the last years, it has become the target of large-scale gold mining development. More than 160,000 hectares of this territory, that's probably right around 400,000 acres, are now undermining concessions with major projects proposed by Mexico's Frisco Company and Canada's Vancouver-based Almaden Minerals. To power these projects, the three principal rivers of the region, the Apulco, Zimpuala, and Ahalpan, are now slated to be dammed for hydroelectricity. Energex Renewable Resources of Longueuil, Quebec, is one of the partners within this initiative. 8 years ago, a broad coalition of local organizations came together to pass into law regional territory management plan to protect the lands and waters of this highly productive region. It is an expression of the indigenous rights to manage their territories into Mexican administrative law. The Committee de Ornamento Territorial de Quetzalan is charged with the enforcement of this management plan. Until his death last week, Manuel Gaspar, as well as seven other individuals charged by local authorities in the CFA, were all members of this implementation committee. Given the above, we call upon the solidarity of all citizens to demand that their political representatives uphold indigenous and environmental rights in the Sierra Norte del Puebla. We specifically call upon the Canadian Embassy in Mexico and relevant members of Canada's public service to work with our counterparts in Mexico to ensure a full and impartial investigation into Manuel Gaspar Rodriguez's death. And a California comeback for the gray wolf hits the farthest point south in this story from KQED as found on the Earth First Newswire. Gray wolves are trekking farther south in California. A two-year-old female known as OR-54 recently wandered through Nevada County in the northern Sierra Nevada. Until now, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife had reported wolves only as far south as Lassen County. She's made her way all the way down into the Sierra, and that's so exciting because this is its prime wolf habitat, said Amarok Weiss of the Center for Biological Diversity. It's an area that scientists have identified for a long time as being good wolf habitat. The wolf is collared with a GPS transmitter that allows officials to determine her whereabouts just off Interstate 80 near Boreal Mountain. OR-54 is so named because she was the 54th wolf Oregon biologists have radio collared. She's following in her father's historic footsteps, known as OR-7. He was the first gray wolf to cross into California from Oregon in almost 90 years. Wolves are making a comeback in the West after they were eradicated by humans during the 1920s. The fact that we have wolves coming back to California is a great testament to the Federal and State Endangered Species Act protections that have allowed this remarkable species to recover, Weiss said. This is the second time OR-54 has visited California. She crossed the border in January and stayed until late February. California Department of Fish and Wildlife wolf specialist Kent Lawden said someone outside of Chester, California, caught her on video during her first visit. She went home for a few months and then returned in mid-April. It's common for wolves to leave their pack at about her age. When wolves are somewhere between 2 and 3 years, they make their first solo wilderness outings, likely in search of a mate. Currently, biologists know of 6 other wolves with radio collars living either in Plumas or Lassen counties, and there could be more that have remained under the radar or GPSs of biologists. Wolves are very shy animals. If they see, smell, or hear you, they're probably going to be gone before you see them, Weiss said. Wolves are not normally dangerous to humans. In the past 100 years, 2 humans have fallen prey to wolves in all of North America, including Canada, Alaska, and the 48 lower states. Weiss said it's questionable whether a wolf actually killed a second person. In contrast, she said about 20 people die annually from encounters with livestock. You would be more likely to die from a lightning strike than from a wolf, Weiss says. She hopes more pups arrived in California this spring. Weiss speculated that the Lassen pack had a litter a few months ago. Wolves usually breed around Valentine's Day, appropriately enough, and pups arrive around mid-April. She expects pups to emerge from their dens any day now. The state's wolf management plan estimates that Northern California, not including the Sierra Nevada, could support up to 500 wolves. And in a news break, agency is considering dropping wolf protections. The federal government is considering another attempt to drop legal protections for gray wolves across the lower 48 states, reopening a lengthy battle over the predator species. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on Thursday told the Associated Press it has begun a science-based review of the status of the wolf, which presently is covered by the Endangered Species Act in most of the nations and cannot be killed unless threatening human life. If the agency decides to begin the process of removing the wolf from the endangered species list, it will publish a proposal at the end of the year. Any proposal will follow a robust, transparent, and open public process that will provide opportunity for public comment, the service said in a statement to the AP. The government first proposed revoking the wolf's protected status in 2013, but backed off after federal courts struck down its plan for delisting species in the Great Lakes region. Long despised by farmers and ranchers, wolves were shot, trapped, and poisoned out of existence in most of the U.S. by the mid-20th century. Since securing protections in the 1970s, they have bounced back in parts of the country. They total about 3,800 in the western Great Lakes states of Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. Other established populations are in the northern Rockies, where they are no longer listed as endangered, and the Pacific Northwest. Federal regulators contend they've recovered sufficiently for their designations as a danger to be removed and management responsibilities handed over to the states. Environmental groups say it's too early for that, as wolves still haven't returned to most of their historical range. Time and time again, the courts have told the service that wolves need further recovery before their protections can be removed, said Colette Adkins, attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity. But the agency is dead set on appeasing special interests who want to kill these amazing animals. Members of Congress have tried numerous times to strip wolves of legal protection. Another bill to do so is pending in the U.S. House. And water clarity at Lake Tahoe has sunk to an all-time low, report finds in this story by Molly Sullivan of the Sacramento Bee. The famed crystal blue waters of Lake Tahoe are muddier than ever, researchers say. The combination of extreme drought and heavy rainfall in 2017 washed 12,000 tons of sediment into the lake, causing the 2017 average clarity levels to drop to the lowest on record, according to a new clarity report from the Tahoe Environmental Research Center at UC Davis. Clarity is measured by lowering a 10-inch white disc called a Secchi disc into the water until it is no longer visible, the report said. The average clarity level was 59.7 feet in 2017, which is a 9.5-foot decrease from 2016. The average for 2017 also surpassed the previous record low in 1997, in which 5,000 tons of sediment flowed into the lake from mountain streams, said Jeffrey Schilato, director of the Tahoe Environmental Research Center. Summer temperatures at Lake Tahoe were also the warmest on record, and research has predicted that warming lake temperatures could hold fine sediment particles closer to the surface longer, reducing clarity, according to the report. However, Schlatto called the all-time low in the average clarity a freak confluence rather than a new normal. During the drought, only about 1,000 tons of sediment was flowing into Lake Tahoe per year, so the record rainfall in 2017 washed 5 years of material into the lake. Researchers continue to monitor the lake's clarity to see if normal trends resume. So far, clarity improved to 65 feet last week. That's right where we should expect it to be, if not a little bit better. Work is being done to keep sediment out of Lake Tahoe, the report said. The goal is to reach a lake clarity of 100 feet. The low clarity level in the lake has no major impact on recreational activities, Schlatto said. People who come still see this incredible blue lake. And from Reuters, we read that a probe has found PG&E power lines sparked the deadly 2017 California wildfires in this story by Steve Gorman. A dozen of the wind-driven blazes that swept Northern California's wine country last fall, killing 46 people in the deadliest firestorm in state history, were sparked by PG&E-owned power lines, as state officials said on Friday. The California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, or CAL FIRE, also said its investigators had found evidence of alleged violations of state law by Pacific Gas and Electric Company and referred those cases to county prosecutors for further review. PG&E issued a statement in response saying the company looked forward to reviewing the CAL FIRE reports, adding, "We continue to believe our overall programs meet our state's high standards." The findings could have tremendous implications for the San Francisco-based utility company in terms of potential legal liability for one of California's most lethal and costly disasters. PG&E shares were down 0.6% in aftermarket trading following the CAL FIRE statement. The agency's investigation covered 12 individual blazes, accounting for much of the conflagrations that erupted on the night of October 8th and raced across several counties north of San Francisco, collectively dubbed the North Bay Fires or the October 2017 Fire Siege. The firestorm claimed 46 lives, scorched at least 245,000 acres, and incinerated 8,900 homes and other structures, including entire subdivisions in the Sonoma County town of Santa Rosa. An estimated 100,000 people were placed under evacuation orders, and the region's renowned winemaking region was thrown into turmoil. The state's insurance commissioner put insured losses from the tragedy at $9 billion. Causes cited by CAL FIRE included downed power lines and trees blown into electrical wires, all equipment owned by PG&E, during the course of fierce winds that roared through the region to spread the resulting flames with unprecedented speed. Code violations were alleged in 88 of the 12 fires under examination, CAL FIRE said. A CAL FIRE spokesman, Michael Moeller, said agency officials look for specific lapses ranging from maintenance and equipment failures to improper vegetation clearance, but he declined to discuss specific findings because the matter remains under investigation. Last month, the agency similarly issued findings for the first four fires it examined from the North Bay incident, concluding those two were triggered by trees falling onto PG&E power lines. Alleged clearance violations were cited in three of those instances. Moeller said investigations are still underway for several remaining fires from last October's outbreak. PG&E, in a statement, said it meets or exceeds regulatory requirements for maintaining its utility poles, inspecting every electrical transmission and distribution line at least once a year, and pruning or removing some 1.4 million trees annually. The company cited the new normal of heightened year-round wildfire hazards created by years of prolonged drought and millions of dead trees. In the case of last year's disaster, PG&E also pointed to the confluence of an unusually wet winter spurring heavy growth in vegetation, which then dried out in record-setting summer heat to set the stage for explosive fire activity when high winds struck in the fall. Succulent plant poachers have been convicted in Humboldt County in this story from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Three defendants in a succulent plant poaching case out of Humboldt County have each pled guilty to two felonies and other misdemeanor charges, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and Humboldt County District Attorney's Office announced. Felony convictions included conspiracy and false filings with the government, and misdemeanor convictions including removal of plant material from public lands and commercial sales of plants removed from public lands. The succulent plants at the center of the investigation are called Dudleas. They grow in unique niches close to the coastline, typically on cliff sides immediately adjacent to the water. The poachers had a network of buyers in Korea and China, where Dudleas are valued as a trendy houseplant. Removal of Dudleas or any vegetation in sensitive habitat can result in environmental degradation of habitat and destabilization of bluffs and cliffs on the coastline. Some Dudleas species are rare or at risk of extinction. Wildlife officers worked extensively with allied law enforcement from U.S. Customs Border Protection and the U.S. Postal Service inspectors to track down and collect evidence of poaching the succulent plants for overseas sales. During the investigation, wildlife officers witnessed the three removing plants from coastal bluffs in Humboldt Lagoon State Park. On April 4th, officers found the trio in possession of 2,300 Dudleas plants and more than $10,200 in cash. All three defendants are foreign nationals, and all from China or Korea, and were handed a sentence of 3 years and 8 months in state prison and a $10,000 fine each. Judge John T. Finney suspended the prison sentence with the conditions that the defendants were prohibited from entering the United States without prior authorization of the federal government and state courts, and prohibited from entering any local, state, or national park. In addition to the fines, defendants will also forfeit the $10,200 to the CDFW as restitution. These funds will be used specifically for conservation of Dudleas on public lands in Humboldt County. Together with Prosecuting Deputy Attorney General Adrian Kamada and Humboldt County District Attorney's Office, we hope this conviction and sentencing will send a message to those who may consider poaching California's precious natural resources to sell overseas for direct personal profit, said David Bess, CDFW Deputy Director and Chief of Law Enforcement. Disease killing millions of bats has made major advances into the West, in this story from the Center for Biological Diversity. The fungal disease that had wiped out entire bat populations in the eastern United States and Canada in the last decade made major advances into the West this spring. Since April, wildlife officials have announced the first discoveries of the fungal pathogen that causes white nose syndrome on bats in Wyoming and South Dakota. Officials also noticed finding white nose syndrome for the first time in Kansas, along with the Canadian province of Manitoba. The first report of bat disease in Newfoundland and Labrador was made this May as well. The brutal wave of white nose syndrome is now breaking in the West, and it's going to slam bats and wreak havoc on the natural balance they've maintained, said Molly Madison, a senior scientist for the Center for Biological Diversity. Bats eat millions of pounds of insects in the U.S. every year. Without them, farm crops and forests will suffer from insect damage. This is an economic crisis, not just an ecological one. A total of 10 bat species have now been documented with white nose syndrome. Millions of bats have persisted, and the disease has spread to 32 states since first detected in upstate New York in 2006. And that was millions of bats have perished, excuse me. Some bat populations have plummeted by more than 99% within 3 to 4 years of first detection of the illness in their area. Biologists fear new bat species in the West will be threatened with extinction, like bats in the eastern United States and Canada, as the disease moves into the last unaffected bat populations on the continent. The Center for Biological Diversity has pursued increased protections for several bat species devastated by white nose syndrome. The center petitioned to protect the northern long-eared bat under the Endangered Species Act in 2010. The bat was listed as threatened in 2015. The center then petitioned for the listing of the tricolored bat in 2016. Its status is still under review by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The federal government should focus on decreasing threats to bats, such as destruction of bat habitat through logging and mining and disturbance of bat caves and roosts by recreation or development, Madison said. We also need to boost funding to develop white nose syndrome treatments to hopefully reduce bat mortality rates and give species a better chance at survival. And fishing and conservation groups have sued to protect coho salmon from Oregon State Forest logging. In this story from the Center for Biological Diversity, 5 fishing and conservation groups sued the Oregon Department of Forestry for poor logging and road use practices in the Tillamook and Catsup State Forests that harm threatened coho salmon through landslides and erosion into streams that violate the Endangered Species Act. The lawsuit was filed in Eugene by the Center for Biological Diversity, Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, Institute for Fisheries Resources, Cascadia Wildlands, and Native Fish Society. Logging by the Oregon Department of Forestry is one of the main reasons our coastal coho are in trouble, said Noah Greenwald, Endangered Species Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. The department needs to do more to ensure it doesn't harm these beautiful and important fish. Forestry Department officials developed a draft habitat conservation plan in the late 1990s that would have granted them a permit to allow some harm to threatened and endangered species, including the coho, marbled murrelet, and spotted owl, but only in exchange for long-term habitat protections. The department, however, never finalized the plan. Forestry officials did not want to enact stream protections that National Marine Fisheries Service scientists determined were necessary to ensure the coho's survival. The Forestry Department is again looking at developing a plan, but has made no firm commitment to do so. Poor logging practices by the Oregon Department of Forestry is causing real harm to Oregon coast coho and commercial fishing families who depend on these magnificent fish for their livelihoods, said Glenn Spain, Northwest Regional Director for both the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations and the Institute of Fisheries Resources. Stronger protections for streams to protect the coho, clean water, and fishing-dependent jobs and communities is decades overdue. The 2 state forests contain nearly 500,000 acres on the Oregon North Coast, essential to the survival of Oregon coast coho. The lack of adequate stream protections on these lands was a primary basis for the National Marine Fisheries decisions to protect the fish under the Endangered Species Act. That agency determined in a 2011 status review that we are unable to conclude that the state forestry management plans will provide for Oregon coastal coho salmon habitat that is capable of supporting populations that are viable during both good and poor marine conditions. The Oregon Department of Forestry is taking such a short-sighted approach to the Tillamook and Catslop State Forests, said Nick Cady, legal director at Cascadia Wildlands. These older coastal rainforests are critical to the future of coho salmon, and there are better uses for these forests than the short-term profit to be gained from clear-cutting. And why are the Earth's oldest baobab trees dying in this story from the Mother Nature Network? Baobab trees are ancient, iconic structures with stocky branches that jut out haphazardly from rugged, thick trunks. These odd-looking trees can grow to an enormous size and are found in low-lying areas in Africa and Australia. Baobabs are sometimes known as upside-down trees because their spindly branches look like roots reaching up to the sky. The iconic trees are also called monkey bread trees because of their plentiful fruit. Until recently, these trees seem nearly indestructible. People have used their cavernous trunks for home, shop, storage, and even a cocktail bar. But then they began to topple. In early 2016, the Sundland baobab in South Africa, which had grown to an impressive 62 feet tall and nearly 112 feet in girth, began to split. By late 2017, it had collapsed completely. The Sundland baobab, also called the Platteland tree, had been functioning as a cocktail bar, though some thought perhaps all of those people visiting the tree's innards may have been the reason for its demise, but it wasn't the only baobab that crumbled. A large number of the oldest and largest baobabs in Africa have died within the last 12 years, researchers report in a new study in the journal Nature Plants. They found that 9 of the 13 oldest have died or are near death, having lost the oldest parts and stems over the last 12 years. Such a disastrous decline is very unexpected, study coordinator Adrian Patrut, a chemist at Romania's Babeș-Bolyai University, told NPR, "It's a strange feeling because these trees may live for 2,000 years or more, and we see that they're dying one after another during our lifetime. It's statistically very unlikely." And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 p.m. right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. for a rebroadcast of this show as part of our Environment Friday programming. You could also tune in to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 in the morning, KBOG 97.9 in Bandon, Oregon, Fridays at 10 a.m., KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m., WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. Here in California, KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill and Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 in Berkeley, California, all rebroadcast the Earth First Update. Or you can always go to the website radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. Or you can listen online or download this or any previous Earth First Update. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in 2 weeks for another edition of the Earth First Update. I will be out of town next week, out in the wilderness. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.